Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Christian. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program, the Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Multiple Myeloma. And today's program is supported by GlaxoSmithKline and an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson Healthcare Systems, Inc., and I really want to thank them for supporting this program today. Now, before I introduce our speakers for today's program, I just want to acknowledge that we have over 200 participants on the call today who come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Lebanon, Nepal, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call as well. And it's really a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Andrew Yi. And Dr. Yi is instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. And Dr. Yi will be addressing discussion of progress in the treatment of multiple myeloma and current standard of care, including clinical trial updates. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Yi.
Thank you, Carolyn, for the introduction, and I'd like to thank the Cancer Care as well as the sponsors for helping to make this event possible and to allow us to share some of the exciting new developments for multiple myeloma. And so I'm going to talk about the standard of care and how that has rapidly evolved over the years based on recent clinical trials. So when we think about multiple myeloma treatment, we can divide it into treatments for patients who are newly diagnosed and then for patients where the disease relapses and patients need another type of treatment to regain the response that they previously achieved. And for newly diagnosed patients, some of the exciting developments have really been using more combinations of drugs to get a deeper response, but meanwhile maintaining good quality of life and without necessarily having more side effects. So over the years, for myeloma treatment for newly diagnosed patients, and we're thinking about, say, for transplant eligible or younger patients, I know Dr. Hartley Brown may talk a little bit more about transplant. We think treatments is starting to move from a three-drug regimen, which some patients on the call and caregivers may be familiar with, like such as RVD, which is Revlimid, Velcade, and dexamethasone, which is a three-drug regimen. Now we're increasingly incorporating daratumumab, also known as Darzalex, which is a monoclonal antibody that targets CD38. So, and we call this regimen, for example, DAR-RVD, which is a four-drug regimen, which is a quad regimen. And some of this work has moved on from an initial phase two study called the Griffin study, and that was led by Dr. Voorhees and one of Dr. Paul and Dr. Varga's colleagues. And that was a phase two study, which really put this regimen on the map, and it showed that patients on this regimen had deeper responses, the durability of the response lasted longer. And so based on that study, patients have, various institutions have started to use that regimen. And one of the more exciting developments was we heard about this Perseus study, which is a randomized phase three study, and that was presented at this recent American Society of Hematology meeting in December. And what makes the difference between the Perseus study and the Griffin study is that really the number of patients. And a phase three study is designed to more definitively answer the question of the differences between regimen A versus regimen B, whereas a phase two study, you start to see if there's a signal for a difference. So in the Perseus study, which was about a 700-patient study, it really showed that when you add the daratumumab drug to the RVD backbone, you do see it does translate into improvements in people having the disease staying away longer, which we call like progression-free survival, as well as improvements in overall survival. So I think that's been a really exciting development, and I think that will help enable access for this, and particularly for, you know, areas where insurance can, where in terms of getting onto the guidelines, in terms of having insurance cover this regimen. So I think that's a really exciting new development. I think this will become a new standard of care. Related to that, there are other regimens looking at isatuximab, also known as Sarclisa, which is another CD38 antibody, and there are other regimens looking at carfilzomib in combination. But in terms of, you know, the phase 3 data where you're starting to see some mature results, I think that's been one of the most exciting developments. And I think it can really translate to patients who are newly diagnosed in terms of, you know, living longer and living better, which is one of the key goals of the treatment, and which is why whenever you hear us speak about these treatments, we're really excited because I think they really translate into important gains for our patients. For patients, you know, with relapse disease, there also have been some really exciting developments really in the past couple years. And some of the most exciting developments have been, as probably many of you know, the treatments which target BCMA, which is a B-cell maturation antigen. So we talked about CD38 being on the surface of, it's a protein on the surface of myeloma cells. There's also another protein called BCMA, which is also on the surface of myeloma cells. And you can target this BCMA protein through a variety of targets. I'm sorry, through a variety of means such as chimeric antigen receptor T cells, which is taking your own white blood cells and they get reprogrammed to attack myeloma cells. And we also have bispecific antibodies, which are antibodies that directly bind to this protein of myeloma cells as well as engage the immune system. So you kind of have a more direct two-for-one effect in terms of being able to attack the myeloma cells. And in the past 2 years and so, we have now four therapies which target BCMA. We have two CAR T-cell therapies such as Abecma and Carvykti, and then we have two bispecific antibodies, which is like such as teclistamab, also known as Tecvayli, and then elranatamab, also known as Elrexfio. And right now, these regimens are approved for patients who have four prior lines of therapy. So patients have the four different types, four different regimens. And for many patients, these regimens have been, you know, transformational. I mean, like a few years ago, these regimens were in clinical trials, and everyone's so excited about them, and now we have access to them. And the other exciting development is that initially CAR T-cell therapy has been so challenging to access, and now the availability is substantially improved over the years. I do appreciate, though, that, you know, CAR T-cell therapy and bispecific, but they each have their own advantages, and some patients, CAR T-cell therapy can be better. In other patients, the bispecific antibody can be an excellent regimen option as well. I should also mention another exciting development is another target, GPRC5D. I know it's kind of a mouthful, and there's a new drug called talquetamab, which is another bispecific antibody which targets that. So all told, in the past 2 or 3 years, we've had five different therapies for patients with relapsed disease, I think for people on the call, you know, for the caregiver, for the providers on the call, we've all seen some really transformational effects of these regimens, which makes it, such a hopeful period of time to be a patient. So I just wanted to conclude that, you know, the standard of care is rapidly changing, and also leading to, I think, really concrete benefits for our patients. And I'd like to turn it over to Carolyn to introduce our next speaker.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Yee. That was just a wonderful presentation, quite stellar. And actually, you really set the stage for today's program, so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Monique Hartley-Brown. And Dr. Hartley-Brown is an attending physician Jerome Lipper Multiple Myeloma Center, Department of Medical Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Hartley Brown will be addressing new and emerging treatments and the role of transplantation. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hartley Brown.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mesner. I really want to say thank you for you and the cancer care team for inviting me here today to speak. And thank you for the participants and patients who are listening in. I know this is really important information that you're gathering for yourself or your loved ones. And so I just wanted to start off today by reviewing some of the new and emerging treatments. Dr. Yi just identified quite a few therapies that are really new that have been FDA approved within the last couple of years. And my task today is to kind of go over some of what's emerging, what's in the pipeline, what's next, what are we going to see in the next couple of years or 5 years maybe, 2 to 5 years I would say. And then after that, I'll pivot roles and I'll discuss a little bit more about the role of transplantation, given that we have all these new therapies in multiple myeloma. I'd like to start this off by also reminding everyone that multiple myeloma is, as yet, still an incurable malignancy. So it's still a cancer that we don't have a defined cure for. That being said, we have lots of good news, lots of therapies that are available for treating this particular condition, and lots of other therapies that are coming in the pipeline. So many of you, if you're a patient or caregiver, as Dr. Yi had earlier mentioned, are familiar with lenalidomide or Revlimid, which is a part of the immunomodulatory agent family. And so this is a pill that you take, and it's a part of the regimen that is often started for treatment with in combination with other medications. So Revlimid, Velcade, and dexamethasone is a very, very commonly used regimen in the beginning of your diagnosis, and sometimes those medications are combined with daratumumab, which Dr. Yi just mentioned. I preface that by saying, you know, there are other medications that are similar to the lenalidomide family that are being looked at in clinical trials, and these medications are even more potent, meaning they work very, very well. They still have very manageable side effect profiles, and we're seeing some very favorable outcomes with patients in these clinical trials. So the first one I wanted to mention is called iberdomide. So iberdomide, and we don't have a generic slash we don't have a generic slash pharmaceutical name yet. We just have iberdomide, and I could give you the name CC, you know, whatever, but I'm not going to blog you with that. I'm just going to say iberdomide, which is a pill similar to Revlimid. It's called a cereblon modulator, but essentially it's in that family of the family. It's more potent, and it can be combined with dexamethasone, and we're seeing some very good favorable results with this medication in phase 1 and phase 2 clinical trials. Now, there's data from the phase 1 clinical trial with iberdomide that has been published, so for you guys who are much more in tune with looking this information up, I just wanted to mention that. Now we're looking at how do we combine it with other medications that we know work very well in the treatment of multiple myeloma. And so there are also clinical trials that are looking at iberdomide in combination with daratumumab, in combination with Kyprolis or carfilzomib in combination with bortezomib or Velcade. And so what we're seeing is very favorable outcomes in this setting of patients who have been having relapsed myeloma after treated with all these multiple agents that are already FDA approved, and then when they still have recurrence of their disease, including patients who have been treated with BCMA-directed therapy. So Dr. Yu mentioned some of the novel BCMA-directed therapies that were just approved within the past couple of years. Even those patients will still see results with some of these medications. So I think, you know, iberdomide is something to look out for because that is in line for potential, you know, next therapy. And the nice thing about iberdomide is, again, it's an oral medication. So you take a pill in combination with your other medications. And so for those people who may not have easy access to a center that could facilitate bispecific antibody or CAR T cell therapy, this may be a favorable option in the next couple of years. The other agent I want to mention is mezigdomide. Mezigdomide is another step up from iberdomide. Again, being looked at in clinical trials, there's a couple of ongoing clinical trials, Successor 1, Successor 2, Successor 3. and essentially, these are phase 1, 2, 3 clinical trials that are looking at mezigdomide in combination with dexamethasone or in combination with other agents such as daratumumab, carfilzomib, elotuzumab, et cetera. And we are, again, seeing very, very promising results with a side effect profile that is not as, which is manageable and not as concerning for us. No new side effects that we cannot manage in the outpatient setting. So these are a couple of things that I wanted to mention. Just a quick mention in terms of bispecifics and CAR T cell therapy, there's a lot of clinical trials right now looking at how best do we use these medications and can we use them earlier on rather than late in relapse. And so, and then also what do we use after in the setting of relapse given that these are such potent therapies. So some of the clinical trials that are emerging are looking at these agents maybe in first relapse or you know, not in late relapse. So those are some of the things I wanted to identify for you. And finally, just to pivot for the last couple of minutes, I wanted to identify that transplantation many of you already know about, but this is still something that is very, very important in management of multiple myeloma. And that goes back to the fact that we know that multiple myeloma is not a curable condition. And so repeatedly, we've had studies that looked at, you know, the role of transplant and what its impact is in terms of the outcomes for patients. And the most recent trial that looked at that was the Phase 3 Determination Trial, which was published back in 2022. And again, this trial looked at a triplet therapy regimen, which was the lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, which is that common triplet that you all probably are familiar with, which is Revlimid, Velcade, and Dex, same thing. And it looked at patients who got transplant after getting the triplet regimen, getting transplant versus those who did not get transplant. And I mean, the underlying point from the study was essentially that, you know, transplant is still important. Transplant still results in a longer or better outcome for patients who can undergo transplant. However, when you look at the details of the study and look at some of the intricacies of the study and the outcomes, you find that there are some patients who may not necessarily need transplant in the first upfront setting. And so it tells us that there's more that we need to do. There's more that we need to learn about myeloma in terms of personalizing medications for our patients, because not necessarily all patients may require a stem cell transplantation in the frontline setting. That being said, we still have good data to support use of transplantation for those patients who are transplant eligible. And with that, I really, really would like to thank you for having me, and I would like to hand it over back to Dr. Messner and allow for the next speaker to continue. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Hartley Merritt Brown. That was really a wonderful presentation, stellar, and just so much information. And I know that our participants really appreciate all the information that you provided them. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Barry Paul. And Dr. Paul is Division of Plasma Cell Disorders, Department of Hematologic Oncology and Blood Disorders, Levine Cancer Institute, Carolina's Healthcare System, Atrium Health. And Dr. Paul will be addressing talking with your treatment team about quality of life concerns and preventing and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Paul.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thanks to the Cantor Care team and to all the attendees, both the presenters and the attendees, for having me today. This is a wonderful conference, and I'm happy to be a part of it. So with regard to talking to your treatment team about quality of life concerns, I think it's really important to recognize that quality of life is often subjective, and it's probably not the same for everyone how it's defined. We all understand that there's very much a significance to quality of life. And the FDA understands this as well. They recently stressed that health-related quality of life should be a measured metric in all new trials of anti-cancer drugs. But it can really be difficult to measure it because it is so subjective. And when a trial does show a significant difference between two different agents or two different treatment modalities in regards to quality of life, sometimes it's really hard to recognize how much of that difference is clinically relevant. So it's really important for all patients and caregivers to have an honest conversation about what is important to them specifically. That's going to go a long way towards helping your provider pick the right regimen for you. Whenever I first meet a new patient, I try to ask a lot of questions about their interests and their hobbies, because I think that this really goes a long way to determining how they define quality of life. If I have patients who like to do activities where, you know, neuropathy could be really detrimental, that could go a long way towards diminishing their quality of life. So if I have a patient who plays musical instruments or does a lot of crafts or paints, if they develop peripheral neuropathy, you know, that could potentially really diminish their ability to do those things that they get a lot of joy out of. Similarly, if I have a patient who likes to do activities like golf, play sports, maybe cook, read, that also will determine what the best treatment algorithm will be for them, because certain medications can make tasting food much more challenging, in which case if someone really likes to cook, that could make that more challenging. Similarly, if someone has a real interest in reading, medications that may impair vision could be really challenging. Also, if patients like to travel, frequent travelers, and if they travel for long periods of time, that may determine that we have to use more of an oral-based regimen than something that requires injections or intravenous infusions and trips back and forth to the infusion center. So these are all things that I think it's important to have a dialogue about. I also recognize that when I'm meeting a patient for the first time, sometimes they're, you know, really debilitated from having undiagnosed, untreated myeloma. You know, perhaps they unfortunately presented with a pathologic fracture, severe fatigue, renal failure, and in that setting, their goals may change or their hobbies may change. So it's a dialogue that continues to happen as patients are being treated and managed. I will say that I feel that I often meet patients who are more concerned about under-treatment in an effort to protect their overall benefit at the detriment of their quality of life. In other words, they'd prefer to have more aggressive therapy even if they think it may impact their quality of life. I've actually had a lot of patients tell me, just do what you feel you need to do and I'll make it work. When I have that conversation with patients who say that kind of topic to me, I try to stress that myeloma, it's unlike other cancers in the respect that we manage it like a chronic disease often. And sometimes more aggressive therapy can lead to diminishing returns. Additionally, we have so many different treatment options. You've heard a lot of different options that have been presented already, and so many new and emerging therapies that are really exciting, that I think we are usually able to tailor a regimen for most patients that will adequately treat their disease while still allowing them to have the appropriate ability to do the things that they really enjoy. So again, having an open dialogue with your provider only helps to make sure that you're giving the best treatment for that specific patient, which often leads to better outcomes. I also would say that I know it can be an awkward conversation sometimes. So if you're feeling like you can't necessarily speak to your provider openly about some symptoms or challenges you may be experiencing, there's often many different members of the team, and maybe you can talk to the nurse, to the nurse navigator, to the social worker, pharmacist, or even have a family member speak to the provider on your behalf if there's something that you're just not able to put in context. And oftentimes I feel like during appointments we're overly focused on the response to the treatment, and we maybe don't cover some of these other issues as much as we would like. So sometimes these are topics that are best discussed through messaging apps and phone calls after appointments if those topics haven't been adequately addressed. So again, if there's a common theme here, it would be to have that open dialogue. Now, all myeloma therapy can be associated with side effects, and certainly myeloma can cause all sorts of challenges as well. So, I want to talk about that. And it's really important to recognize that myeloma patients are going to have all sorts of symptoms. Traditionally, they suffer from things like pain, both neuropathic pain, mechanical pain, fatigue, infections, and then the treatments that we use can cause things like nausea, decreased appetite, diarrhea, swelling, nail changes, insomnia, more increased risk of infections. So helping to prevent and manage these symptoms is extremely important. Certain medications are often used to prevent side effects from occurring. Things like acyclovir, antibiotics, and IVIG can often be used to prevent certain infections. And we oftentimes will prophylactically treat with some nausea medications if someone's going to get a treatment that predisposes them to having pretty significant nausea. But even with these measures, side effects can still be common, and that's where communication is key. If you're having side effects, you need to let us know, and certainly it's important to tell us about the severity, the timing, the duration of your symptoms, especially in respect to when you got your therapy. That can really help us to determine what the offending agent is. As you've heard today, we use a lot of combination therapies, so oftentimes if patients are having side effects, we need to dissect out which agent is the one that's causing the problem so we can appropriately address it. So, for instance, if you have diarrhea or fatigue, but it improves on days when you're not taking Revlimid, if you're on a Revlimid or lenalidomide, the other name for Revlimid, if you're on that agent and you're taking it for 3 weeks on and 1 week off, or 2 weeks on and 1 week off, and the symptoms improve during your off week, then we can probably say that that's the offending agent. And then, other types of things, if you have neuropathy after a Velcade shot, or if you have shortness of breath after carfilzomib infusions or Kyprolis infusions, that needs to be reported to your provider, because those things can be reversed if we can catch it early, but if we kind of try to ignore it and we just continue to treat, these things can become more problematic down the road. Another example is if you're getting a bone-directed therapy like Xgeva or Zometa, if you're having bone pain a couple of days after you have the infusion, that's not as concerning as if you're having bone pain on other days. If you're having bone pain on other days, then that could be more evidence of the myeloma. And then finally, we need to also be sort of coordinating our care with other providers to make sure that if you're having dental work done or if you need surgery for other reasons, that we're making sure that your myeloma therapy is appropriately addressed during that period of time to minimize other side effects that can occur with multiple different providers doing different things at the same time. Lastly, I think it's important to recognize that you should never be embarrassed about any concerns you may have. You should always feel comfortable discussing with your provider, and your provider should always be comfortable listening and trying to determine next steps. Sometimes this may require additional testing or even referrals to other providers. But as myeloma tends to be a disease of older adults, a lot of people oftentimes chalk up nonspecific symptoms to just kind of getting older. If it's bothering you, tell us, because you know we can oftentimes fix these things if we know about them. So the common theme to everything I've discussed today is open dialogue. And with that, I will turn it back to Dr. Messner. And again, thank you all for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Paul. That was really just a wonderful presentation. Lots of really excellent information for our participants. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. You really, really covered the quality of life issues and just the need to communicate with the healthcare team. So thank you so much. I really, really appreciate your presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Cindy Varga. And Dr. Varga is the hematologist, Department of Hematologic Oncology and Blood Disorders, Levine Cancer Institute, Atrium Health, Clinical Associate Professor, Hematology and Oncology, Wake Forest University School of Medicine. And Dr. Varga will be addressing reducing complications of bone disease and guidelines to prepare for telehealth telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, quality of life concerns, follow-up care, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Varga.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate being part of all this. This is my first time doing a cancer care workshop, so I'm really excited. And with that, I'll go ahead and start the talk just a little bit about bone disease and how it relates to myeloma. So, you know, I'm pretty sure everybody on the call knows that myeloma can cause bones to become thinner. So it can cause osteoporosis. It can also make holes in the bones. So those are called lytic lesions. It usually affects the spine, the pelvis, the ribs, the skull, and the long bones of the arms and legs. So it can be quite extensive. And in a in a normal situation, we have this bone maintenance where we have a balance between the breakdown of old bone by osteoclast and the building of new bone by osteoblast. But in multiple myeloma, the disease upsets this dynamic, this balance, and there's more activation of the osteoclasts that break down bone without the bone repair. So what that leads to uncontrollable bone breakdown, unfortunately. And about 80% of patients will eventually develop some kind of bone problem during the course of their disease. So this is a really important topic to discuss. Patients with myeloma, unfortunately, are at risk for pathologic fractures. So the definition of pathologic fracture is when there's a fracture or a break of the bone under minor stress or minor pressure. And so, you know, I've had patients who've coughed or sneezed the wrong way and they've fractured something, or simply a fall that would usually not, cause any damage at all can cause terrible fractures in the long bones. So it's also important that if you have myeloma and, you know, you want to go get a massage, for example, which, you know, I think patients can still do so, but they would have to alert their masseuse about their condition, and I would avoid manipulative therapy with, you know, chiropractors and whatnot because of all the points that I listed just before, because patients are at risk of having complications with their bones. So how do we prevent patients from getting these fractures? I think that I'd like to discuss two ways. So one is screening patients early on to identify if they already have pre-existing lesions. So for example, patients who have smoldering multiple myeloma, we definitely screen them on a yearly basis to make sure that they're not developing early what we call focal lesions. So these are, you know, abnormal areas of bone marrow that might signal the development of a lytic lesion in the next 1 or 2 years. So if on an MRI, for example, we identify more than one focal lesion that measures about 5 millimeters, to us, even if the patient's asymptomatic, we're going to constitute that as a myeloma-defining event, and we'd start therapy in these patients. So screening patients with smoldering myeloma is very empowering because we can, you know, notice these very early lesions and act before they can develop into larger lesions. And what do we use for screening? In the past, we used to use skeletal surveys, so that's x-rays of, you know, all the bones in the body. And even though it's cheap and easily accessible, it has a very poor sensitivity, and it really only picks up advanced bone disease. So this is really no longer recommended for screening purposes. Other modalities include low-dose whole body CT. So this is relatively cheap. It's widely available, and it's quite sensitive. It can pick up lesions that are 5 millimeters or larger, and it has relatively low-dose radiation. Whole body MRI is another modality. However, it's less widely available. It is more expensive. It does require a certain amount of expertise, but there's no radiation exposure, and by far it has the highest sensitivity for detecting that early, those early focal lesions that I was talking about. And finally, there's PET CT, which is expensive. It does have a higher radiation exposure, but it's quite good at detecting active bone disease and active extramedullary disease, so disease outside the bone. So once we do establish that a patient has active bone lesions, how do we treat patients? So the first thing, we have to start anti-plasma cell therapy, so anti-myeloma therapy, because the therapy itself will help control the bone disease. And then next, we want to use bone modifying agents. So there are three bone modifying agents. Two are under a class called bisphosphonate. So those are Zometa and pimidronate. Those are IV infusions that are given monthly. These agents bind to damaged bone and inhibit those osteoclasts, which break down bone. And in studies, they've shown, for example, Zometa, when compared to placebo, it showed some overall survival benefits in patients with myeloma. So very important to start these agents. We have to be careful in patients who have kidney dysfunction, so there might require some dose adjustments and monitoring of the kidney function. And what's important to also note is that even if you don't have any bone disease on evaluation, so if, you know, you're getting started on myeloma therapy for other complications, we do start these bisphosphonates regardless, as we still think we provide benefit to those patients. The next modifying agent is denosumab. This is more of an immunotherapy. It's a monoclonal antibody that binds a protein that controls bone regeneration. It's a subcutaneous treatment that's given monthly. It's safe in kidney dysfunction. So even in patients with very advanced kidney dysfunction, we can use this drug. It's non-inferior to Zometa, one of the drugs I just explained about. And the one thing that patients should know about this is that if it's stopped, there can be this rebound hypercalcemia, so rebound elevated calcium levels once it's discontinued several months later. So sometimes patients are given a dose of Zometa to mitigate that. How long do we continue these drugs for? So for the bisphosphonates, we usually give them on a monthly basis for at least 12 months, especially in the era of these really great novel agents where we get deep responses. And then after those 12 months, if a patient has had a deep response, we can switch it to, and I've seen anywhere from 3 months to 6 months to every 12 months, and some providers even discontinue these drugs based on risk factors of the patient. These drugs should be reinitiated if a patient is in a remission and then progresses or shows signs of biochemical relapse. These agents should be restarted to prevent any adverse bony events. It's important also that patients should be on calcium and vitamin D while they're getting these treatments, but only after their calcium is normalized if they did present with high calcium levels. One of the complications to these therapies is osteonecrosis of the jaw. Very rare complication, but something to look out for. It's when part of the jawbone will poke out of the gum, and that part of the bone stops receiving blood, and so that bone can die. And so it's really important to identify if that is happening. It usually or more likely occurs if a patient has poor oral hygiene or has recurrent oral infections, if they're getting tooth extractions or have dental implants. So it's super important to have patients have dental assessments before starting these bisphosphonates, as well as having regular maintenance, check-ins with their dentist, either every 6 to 12 months while on therapy. These bisphosphonates should be stopped 3 months before and 3 months after any dental procedure. And providers out there should consider starting patients on prophylactic antibiotics in that periprocedural time period to prevent infections. If someone does develop osteonecrosis of the jaw, the bisphosphonate can be restarted eventually. It takes about 4 months for it to heal up. So if there is ongoing active bone disease, we might want to restart it at a later date. With that, I'm going to kind of shift gears now to talk more about telehealth. I think this is the biggest craze now, especially after COVID, where, you know, we weren't able to meet patients in person. So lots of telehealth visits. I think it really benefits some patients who might live very far and want to consult with specialists if they can't make it there. Or even, you know, if a patient has, you know, very stable disease and it's very hard for them to get into the office transportation-wise, this offers another solution. So I think the number one thing that we have to consider with telehealth visits is that, you know, obviously patients should know that they're to make sure their insurance provider does cover these visits, and they should be treated as regular clinic visits. Patients should find, you know, a quiet spot somewhere private where they can talk openly and they're not embarrassed to, you know, discuss whatever's on their mind. Try and reduce background noise as much as possible, and to have no other distractions. So if, you know, you're at work, you could put, you know, a sign on your door saying that you're busy so no one distracts you. Good lighting. You should wear some appropriate clothing. So, if, for example, you need to show something to the provider, if you have a rash somewhere, that you have, you know, clothing that will allow you to show that specific body part to the provider if appropriate. I think it's really important for patients to make sure that they download all the appropriate applications ahead of time, test the technology, the camera, the microphone, ensure that internet access is strong and that it's not going to be spotty, and to familiarize yourself also with the buttons on the program. So, for example, the video camera to make sure that the provider can see you, the microphone logo to know where it is, make sure you're not on mute. There usually is a chat box if you want to ask questions or share some information with the provider, and also the hang-up button to close the application at the end. You know, the camera should definitely be centered at eye level. You should make sure that there's a sound check to make sure that that the provider can hear you. Also, it's important to just shut down all other applications because, as you know, with, you know, dozens of applications open, it'll make the internet go slower, and it can distract you if there are pop-ups. Patients should sign on a little bit earlier than their appointment just to allow for time for troubleshooting. So if there's ever an issue and you can't get on, you can always call the provider's office and let them know something's not working. You know, I'm very guilty of this. Sometimes, you know, I'm running late in my clinic by 10, 15 minutes. So just try and be patient if the provider doesn't show up right away. And know that they probably will come on eventually, just like in a clinic setting. And also have a phone nearby in case something happens and you get kicked out of the visit and you can't reconnect, so the provider can call you and continue the visit on the phone if possible. It's important to have a list of questions available, have a paper and pen close by in case you want to jot down notes. And sometimes it's great if there's an issue and you're not feeling well, that you take your BP if you can, and know if you have a fever or not. So, you know, having the vital signs, if you can, some patients can do that alone at home, is helpful if the patient's not feeling well. And then nearing the end of the visit, just make sure there's a follow-up visit that's set up and that the provider ensures that any referrals or tests that are going to be ordered are explained to the patient so that there's a rationale behind that. It's important also in preparation for these visits that, you know, you have an idea of what you want to discuss with the provider. So, you know, I know Dr. Paul had mentioned about quality of life concerns, so that's equally as important even on a telehealth visit. So, you know, a lot of us providers want to know about fatigue level. You know, are you doing your activities, your hobbies, or are you unable to do those? What's your level of independence? Are you able to complete all your activities of daily living? If you're having neuropathy, are you tolerating the medication that we prescribe for it? Is it getting better or worse? What's your appetite like? Are you gaining weight? Many patients are surprised that they're, you know, on chemo, they're gaining weight because of steroids and whatnot. So it's important to address those concerns. I know in my clinic there's a lot of concerns about cognitive issues, concentration, forgetfulness, even emotional stress or anticipatory stress. So things like my stem cell collections coming up, I'm really nervous about that, or my bone marrow biopsies coming up, or there's this PET scan that I'm waiting on that is really, you know, impacting my quality of life. So it's good to talk to the doctor about those things. And even fear of you know, the unknown of what's going to happen in the future, those are also important to talk to the doctor about. things like insomnia from steroids and chronic pain issues from bone disease is important, since we can always address those and refer patients. And then finally, I'm going to shift to this open notes that recently has become quite accepted across the world when it comes to patients accessing their own lab work, their own clinic notes, being able to read what the doctor is writing after a particular visit. And I think it's important to address that as well, because I think that on the whole, when patients come to these visits, maybe 40-50% of what's communicated might stay in their heads. So this is a good opportunity for patients to go back into their charts after the visit and look at important next steps at things that the doctor had mentioned that they might have forgotten. It also allows the patients to see what the doctor is thinking in terms of interpretation of results. So it might allow the patient to better understand results in their blood work or results in their scans and imaging. So for example, I remember I had a patient that was very worried because he accessed his labs and there was something there that he wasn't sure what it meant. And for a week it tortured him. And instead of just, calling the office and talking to me about it, he was, just a mess and a wreck. So it's always good to, if you read something in your note that you don't know how to interpret, not to think the worst case scenario and always talk to the doctor before, so that it's fleshed out. And usually it's something that's not as bad as the patient had originally, thought or interpreted. I think that, the open notes also allows patients to have better communication with their providers, allows them to get more engaged in their own care. And please, if there's mistakes that you note in the chart, I think it's also really important to allow the provider to identify these errors with the provider so that we can fix them, because some of these errors can have clinical implications. So I think open notes is this new, concept, but I think as a whole, it's probably going to strengthen the bond between patients and providers. And with that, I'm going to throw it back to Carolyn. Thank you so much for your time.
A lot of wonderful and caring information and informative information for our participants. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and she's going to be discussing with you nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's really my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. So nutrition and hydration are essential to not only how we feel and our quality of life, but also to how we tolerate treatment. And a general recommendation is a plant-based diet. Now, a plant-based diet is recommended in prevention, during treatment, and in survivorship. So I'm going to give some information around that. A plant-based diet translates into having about two-thirds of your plate from a plant-based food. And a plant-based food is a whole grain, a fruit, a vegetable, nuts, and seeds. Plant-based foods provide unique components, things like antioxidants, phytochemicals, polyphenols, and fiber, which help our bodies function optimally. Fresh and frozen are the best forms to receive and to consume from consuming our plant-based foods. What's really great is frozen is very economically friendly. It offers us an option to have a lot of diversity in our diet, and it usually tastes better because the food is actually allowed to take the time to ripen and mature on the vine as it was intended to. Fresh oftentimes is harvested quite early due to long travels from where it comes from, and the taste of the food doesn't always match what our expectations are. And there's a lot of protective measures they have to take with foods that are traveling far distances to reduce the decay process. The other third of the plate should come from a lean protein source. A lean protein does not have to come from an animal source. It can come from a plant source, such as a bean, pea or lentil. It can also come in forms as like tofu or tempeh. And then having other protein sources, lean protein sources, such as wild-caught cold water fish, is a great way to bring in some nourishing, high-quality, healthy fats. Also, fish such as warm-caught fish, as long as it's wild-caught, that's what we want to aim for. White-breasted poultry is another lean protein that you can include in your diet as well. So protein, what's so big about protein? Protein is our building block for cells and tissue. It helps with our healing. It helps with development. So there's a lot of benefits with protein. Now, during your treatment process, there might be a need to modify your diet, maybe change some things that, based on your unique needs. And so being in touch with your healthcare team is very important. Knowing how to reach the members of your healthcare team are important. A dietitian is part of your healthcare team. We're here to help support you during your journey and ensure that your questions and concerns are addressed related to diet and nutrition. Now, dehydration is something we obviously get missed in the mix sometimes because we're so focused on questions about nutrition and monitoring your weight and, you know, things along those lines. But dehydration is very common amongst patients, just oftentimes due to side effects from treatment or oftentimes just a change in habit. Maybe the side effects from a treatment or a medication or just a change in your routine may influence this. And dehydration can actually amplify a lot of side effects patients might experience, such as, you know, maybe nausea or fatigue or feeling lightheaded. And not everybody will have any of these potential side effects, but fluids are really anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, sports drinks. And a general guideline is people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. So talk with your team if you have questions about your unique needs. Now, if you're suffering with any side effects or changes in your tolerance to eating or changes in how you're feeling, connect with your healthcare team as quickly as possible. We want to help address your questions and concerns so that you're not struggling any longer than you need to be struggling. And so with that, I want to hand the line back over to Carolyn. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Baird. And that was a wonderful presentation. And I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell. And Dr. O'Donnell is Clinical Director of Early Detection and Prevention Cancer, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And she is going to be addressing lifestyle, physical activity, and balance concerns with practical tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Donnell.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to come here and speak with you today about these very important topics. As providers, we get so many questions about lifestyle and physical activity, and we know that multiple myeloma can significantly impact patients' quality of life and that of their caregivers. In addition to these topics, we'll also be just talking about how to prepare for an upcoming visit. Beginning with lifestyle and physical activity, this is really critical for all patients with multiple myeloma. Our expectation and hope is that for patients with multiple myeloma that they will live for many, many years. This disease can be accompanied by some challenges, though, in terms of physical activity, specifically bone involvement. So while we encourage physical activity, and in particular, staying active and not being sedentary, it is very important to have a conversation with your team and your provider about limitations that might pertain to you. Sometimes initially with the diagnosis of myeloma, there may be concerns about the strength of bones, and so before embarking on a physical activity plan, make sure you talk about it with your team. That said, I highly encourage patients with multiple myeloma to stay active, to do the activities of daily living and the activities that are meaningful and give purpose. Being on therapy for multiple myeloma means being on steroids such as dexamethasone, which can decrease lean body mass and sometimes increase the fat composition around the belly. So staying active can be a very important part of long-term care in multiple myeloma. We also know that any cancer diagnosis, in particular multiple myeloma, can pose challenges to mood, specifically It has been observed that there can be increases in depression and anxiety for those being treated for myeloma and for their caregivers. It is critical that you discuss these aspects of your care with your team. There may be dose modifications that can be made to certain medications, specifically dexamethasone, that can improve your quality of life. Dexamethasone can specifically impact your sleep quality. It can cause insomnia, and timing of when you take this medication, specifically taking it in the morning versus at night, and also potentially reducing the dose if it's causing you symptoms, are things that can be done if your provider knows that you're experiencing these symptoms. So I strongly suggest that you have an open dialogue with your physician and your care team about any symptoms that you might be having so that they can maximize your quality of life. In terms of preparing for visits, this really all ties together. Sometimes you may be going to visits alone. Sometimes you may be accompanied by a family member or friend. It is important when you come to these visits to make the best use of your time. There are certain things that the doctor and team must take care of and ask you about, but there's also a tremendous opportunity for open conversation. Your doctors, your nurse practitioners, your physician's assistants really want to know what's going on. So bring a list if you've been having any symptoms or if you have any questions, bring those with you. Write them down or type them into your phone so you have them to really optimize and make the best use of those visits. I think the most important takeaway from all of this is that your team cares about your quality of life and wants to partner with you and engage with you so that we can optimize all of those factors and give you the best possible outcome. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Donnell. That was just a wonderful presentation and so important for our participants to really stay active and to use some of the lifestyle suggestions that you've made. So thank you so much. And I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services, and then we're going to move on. I'm Carolyn Messner. I'm Senior Director of Education and Training with Cancer Care, and I'd like to discuss Cancer Care's free programs and services with you, and what are they? Well, first of all, people often call our Hope line in the United States. It's 1-800-813-4673. And the phone is answered by oncology social workers, our staff, about 40 of them, and they will answer your questions. So when someone calls, the phone is immediately picked up. The social workers are in queue to pick up questions, so there is no wait time when you call our 800 number. And so sometimes people ask about practical financial and co-payment assistance. That's a big issue. And also issues of food insecurity. So people will often call about those issues. That's a big issue for people. Also, we offer online support groups on different types of cancers, and also for caregivers, for patients and for caregivers, different online groups, and also groups for young adults, older adults, middle-aged adults. So we really cover that whole spectrum, and that actually is on our website at www.cancercare.org. We also do offer these education programs, about 80 of them a year, and we have a number of publications and fact sheets that you can access from our website. And we also have a resource navigation, which is to help you find a resource. Let's say that there is an issue that you're not able to resolve and we don't have that particular resource for you. We will then, that team will stay with you until we get the resource you need. So that's just a thumbnail sketch of all the services that we do offer. We're going to move right on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Krista to explain to everybody how to queue up the questions. We're going to only take online questions, and I'm going to turn this over to Krista now.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
This is a question actually for Dr. Paul. Do you expect that CAR-T will eventually be moved up and be available in early relapses?
So there was very encouraging data for both commercial CAR-T products, both Abecma and Cilta-cel or Carvykti, that was recently published, and we're fully expecting that both of those agents will have earlier designations in the not too distant future. They're currently under FDA review. So Abecma will likely be in 2 to 4 prior lines, and Carvykti will potentially even be in 1 to 3 prior lines. So yes, the answer to that question is I do believe that those will likely be moved into earlier lines of therapy.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And next question for Dr. Varga. Is multiple myeloma passed down through family members, or is it something that simply develops?
Yeah, so it's not genetic in that, you know, if you have it, it's passed down to your kids. There are some instances where we do see in a family multiple patients who might have a plasma cell disorder, so like a family member who has multiple myeloma and another member that might have a monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance. So that rarely happens. But, you know, there are also questions about, you know, exposures. Sometimes myeloma can develop if patients have been exposed to certain chemicals and whatnot. So if there have been, for example, exposures in a family, then you could argue that that family might be at a higher risk of developing multiple myeloma. But, you know, to make a long story short, no, this is not a genetic disease that is passed down from, you know, mom to kid or dad to kid.
And actually, another question for you, Dr. Varga. One of the participants asked, what was the drug Dr. Varga mentioned after Zometa?
Oh, yes, it was called denosumab.
Okay.
So that was the immunotherapy, you know, bone-modifying agent.
Excellent, thank you. I just want to let everybody know that our next multiple myeloma program is next week on March 21st. It's coping with the stresses of caregiving when your loved one has multiple myeloma. So this is a program for caregivers or people living with multiple myeloma who wish to understand better the role of the caregiver. And then another question for Dr. Paul. What is the difference between relapse and remission?
So remission means that your myeloma is undetectable with conventional types of modalities that we have. So that's in the bone marrow as well as in blood. Relapse means that, unfortunately, someone who has been in a remission, now we can detect myeloma again. And, you know, to a certain level, that would mean that they unfortunately have relapsed and now they would need more therapy or a different therapy.
Thank you so much. And question from Dr. Barker, what is the relationship between B12 deficiency and multiple myeloma? Is being vitamin B12 deficient a risk or indicator of multiple myeloma?
So I'm not aware that a B12 deficiency is related or increases your risk of developing multiple myeloma, but we definitely want to make sure that B12 levels are fully repleted because we want to prevent any kind of additional neuropathy that can happen, and patients who have B12 deficiencies can develop neuropathies. And as Dr. Paul had mentioned, you know, some of our therapies cause neuropathy, such as Velcade. So, you know, I often do check B12 levels to ensure that patients don't have deficiencies for that reason.
Excellent. Thank you. And that's a good recommendation for our participants to be aware of. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Paul. What are some of the best methods to manage and prevent kidney damage due to multiple myeloma?
Well, so a couple of things. First and foremost is to have the myeloma be under good control. You know, so the therapy that your doctors will ideally design for your myeloma should get the plasma cell burden down, and the traditional methodology by which myeloma causes kidney disease is by what's called CAS nephropathy, meaning that the antibody levels in your blood almost clog the kidneys up like a hair clog in a sink. So if we can get that level down appropriately, that will help the kidneys. But most importantly that patients can do at home is drink lots of fluids. You heard earlier from Diana that drinking 8 ounces of or 8 glasses of 8 ounces of fluid a day is recommended. And, you know, we really want to push those antibodies through the kidneys as quickly and ideally with the least amount of damage as possible. So lots and lots of fluids is always going to be helpful. And, you know, ideally getting the myeloma under control as well.
So we have a question here. Thank you so much, and a question for Dr. Varga. But we also have a program on vision changes related to cancer treatments. But this question, what are some recommended treatments for dry eyes related to multiple myeloma? Yes, Dr. Varga, sorry.
Yeah. It depends on what the dry eyes are from. So you know, simple dry eyes, you know, you can definitely put normal saline drops in the eyes as needed for comfort. There is a treatment that we do give that can cause a keratopathy, which is an abnormality of the cornea, which can cause blurry vision. And sometimes people complain of like a dry eye. And in those cases, we refer patients to ophthalmologists who will prescribe certain, you know, eye drops to not only prevent those complications, but treat the symptoms of those complications. So some of them are steroid eye drops and whatnot. So, you know, when patients are on a certain type of chemo, which, you know, or rather immunotherapy, which we call belantamab mafodotin, that's an indication for an ophthalmologist to follow those patients carefully.
And I just want to let everybody know that we are doing a program on vision changes with a whole bunch of ophthalmologists and an oncologist as well on Monday, April 8th. So that's you'll be getting information about that program as well. And now I'm just going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. I'm going to ask Dr. Paul and Dr. Varga and Ms. Bearden to just provide takeaways for our participants. So starting with Dr. Paul.
Yeah, thank you. So first, thank you all for attending, and thank you for having me. My biggest takeaway, and hopefully you heard this as a recurring theme, not just with my speech, but with others as well, is communication. You know, it's a dialogue. Myeloma is a heterogeneous disease that can be treated in multiple different ways effectively. We have lots of new and emerging therapies, but what the right therapy is for one patient may not be the right therapy for another. So always make sure you're having an appropriate dialogue with your providers. Be honest with them. Make sure they're being honest with you. So that we can all work together to have the best outcome from a quality of life as well as from a treatment perspective.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Paul. It's wonderful. And Dr. Varga?
Yeah, I definitely want to echo that. I think, you know, it's one thing to, you know, provide anti-plasma cell therapy for patients, but it's quite another to definitely always keep the quality of life in mind. I think that's often missed in clinic visits, and I think that there's no point in giving patients therapy to put them in a remission if patients are miserable in their remission because they have so many side effects and they can't live their life. So I think that is such an important point, and I have to echo that that's probably the clinical pearl that everyone should be taking away from this workshop, is really focus on making sure you have that open communication with your provider and that you do often talk about the quality of life issues that are related to therapy.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Ms. Bearden?
Just to remember, there's lots of members of the healthcare team and know their roles, how to access them, and to reach out to them as quickly as you can when you have an issue arise so that we can help you sooner rather than later.
Excellent. I want to thank our speakers. You've been really superb, and I want to thank our participants as well. And although we have offered this program in the past, I have to say this one has been far and above any other program we've done before, both because of the wonderful speakers and because of wonderful participant questions. And there's more to come, so please be aware of that. Also, I do want to acknowledge that we were not able to take all of your questions. And so for those of you who were able to ask a question, for those of you who have a question in queue, and those of you who are thinking of a question, please go back to your treating healthcare team. They, of course, know you the best. They have your medical records in front of them. So take what you learned today and bring it back to your healthcare team and ask your questions over and over again. And I think all of our speakers have addressed the issue of quality of life issues, and please do, you know, please do focus on that when you speak to your physicians and your healthcare team as well. Remember, your healthcare team consists of both your oncologists, your multiple myeloma doctors, of course, and it also consists of oncology nurses, oncology social workers, patient navigators, financial navigators, a whole bunch of people on that team to help you. So if your physician doesn't know the answer to the question, he will be able to bring in members of the team. Plus, you do have Cancer Care to call, and if we don't have the answer, we will get you help for what you need. But for your medical questions, your healthcare team, of course, is the very best. Also, you'll all be getting a SurveyMonkey after today's program, and in that SurveyMonkey, any resource we gave today will be listed. So although it's an evaluation of the program, you will also be getting a resources that we may have mentioned during the program, or if we didn't mention them, we'll include them. So again, I want to thank you all for participation today. I would not want anyone to leave this call feeling you're alone. You're now part of a community of support, and we're all here to help you. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.